Chapter 8. Certainly that she could marry Percy Grice when she pleased, had lifted a heavy load from her mind, and her money troubles were too recent for their removal, not to leave a sense of relief which a less discerning intelligence might have taken for happiness. Her vulgar cares were at an end. She would be able to arrange her life as she pleased, to soar into that empyrean of security where creditors cannot penetrate. She would have smarter gowns than Judy Treanor, and far, far more jewels than Bertha Dorset. She would be free forever from the shifts, the expedients, the humiliations of the relatively poor. Instead of having to flatter, she would be flattered. Instead of being grateful, she would receive thanks. There were old scores she could pay off as well as old benefits she could return. And she had no doubts as to the extent of her power. She knew that Mr. Grice was of the small cherry type most inaccessible to impulses and emotions. He had the kind of character in which prudence is a vice, and good advice the most dangerous nourishment. But Lily had known the species before. She was aware that such a guarded nature must find one huge outlet of egoism, and she determined to be to him what his Americana had hitherto been. The one possession in which he took sufficient pride to spend money on it. She knew that this generosity to self is one of the forms of meanness, and she resolved so to identify herself with her husband's vanity that to gratify her wishes would be to him the most exquisite form of self-indulgence. The system might at first necessitate a resort to some of the very shifts and expedients from which she intended it should free her. But she felt sure that in a short time she would be able to play the game in her own way. How should she have distrusted her powers? Her beauty itself was not the mere ephemeral possession it might have been in the hands of inexperience. Her skill in enhancing it, the care she took of it, the use she made of it, seemed to give it a kind of permanence. She felt she could trust it to carry her through to the end. And the end, on the whole, was worthwhile. Life was not the mockery as he had thought it 3 days ago. There was room for her, after all, in this crowded selfish world of pleasure whence, so short a time since, her poverty had seemed to exclude her. These people whom as he had ridiculed, and yet envied, were glad to make a place for her in the charmed circle about which all her desires revolved. They were not as brutal and self-engrossed as he had fancied, or rather, since it would no longer be necessary to flatter and humor them, that side of their nature became less conspicuous. Society is a revolving body which is apt to be judged according to its place in each man's heaven, and at present it was turning its illuminated face to Lily. In the rosy glow it diffused, her companion seemed full of amiable qualities. She liked their elegance, their lightness, their lack of emphasis. Even the self-assurance which at times was so like obtuseness now seemed the natural sign of social ascendancy. They were lords of the only world she cared for, and they were ready to admit her to their ranks and let her lord it with them. Already she felt within her a stealing allegiance to their standards, an acceptance of their limitations, a disbelief in the things they did not believe in, a contemptuous pity for the people who were not able to live as they lived. The early sunset was slanting across the park. Through the boughs of the long avenue beyond the gardens she caught the flash of wheels, and divined that more visitors were approaching. There was a movement behind her, a scattering of steps and voices. It was evident that the party about the tea table was breaking up. Presently she heard a tread behind her on the terrace. She supposed that Mr. Grice had at last found means to escape from his predicament, and she smiled at the significance of his coming to join her instead of beating an instant retreat to the fireside. She turned to give him the welcome which such gallantry deserved. But her greeting wavered into a blush of wonder, for the man who had approached her was Lawrence Selden. "You see, I came after all," he said. But before as he had time to answer, Mrs. Dorset, breaking away from a lifeless colloquy with her host, had stepped between them with a little gesture of appropriation. The observance of Sunday at Bellomont was chiefly marked by the punctual appearance of the smart omnibus destined to convey the household to the little church at the gates. Whether anyone got into the omnibus or not was a matter of secondary importance, since by standing there it not only bore witness to the orthodox intentions of the family, but made Mrs. Treanor feel, when she finally heard it drive away, that S.E. had somehow vicariously made use of it. It was Mrs. Treanor's theory that her daughters actually did go to church every Sunday, but their French governess's convictions calling her to the rival fane, and the fatigues of the week keeping their mother in her room till luncheon, there was seldom anyone present to verify the fact. Now and then, in a spasmodic burst of virtue, when the house had been too uproarious overnight, Gus Treanor forced his genial bulk into a tight frock coat, and routed his daughters from their slumbers. But habitually, as Lily explained to Mr. Grice, this parental duty was forgotten till the church bells were ringing across the park, and the omnibus had driven away empty. Lily had hinted to Mr. Grice that this neglect of religious observances was repugnant to her early traditions, and that during her visits to Bellomont she regularly accompanied Muriel and Hilda to church. This tallied with the assurance, also confidentially imparted, that, never having played bridge before, S.E. had been ragged into it on the night of her arrival, and had lost an appalling amount of money in consequence of her ignorance of the game, and of the rules of betting. Mr. Grice was undoubtedly enjoying Bellomont. He liked the ease and glitter of the life, and the luster conferred on him by being a member of this group of rich and conspicuous people. But he thought it a very materialistic society. There were times when he was frightened by the talk of the men, and the looks of the ladies, and he was glad to find that Miss Bart, for all her ease and self-possession, was not at home in so ambiguous an atmosphere. For this reason he had been especially pleased to learn that she would, as usual, attend the young Treanors to church on Sunday morning, and as he paced the gravel sweep before the door, his light overcoat on his arm, and his prayer book in one carefully gloved hand, he reflected agreeably on the strength of character which kept her true to her early training in surroundings so subversive to religious principles. For a long time Mr. Grice and the omnibus had the gravel sweep to themselves. But, far from regretting this deplorable indifference on the part of the other guests, he found himself nourishing the hope that Miss Bart might be unaccompanied. The precious minutes were flying, however. The big chestnuts pawed the ground and flecked their impatient sides with foam. The coachman seemed to be slowly petrifying on the box, and the groom on the doorstep, and still the lady did not come. Suddenly, however, there was a sound of voices, and a rustle of skirts in the doorway, and Mr. Grice, restoring his watch to his pocket, turned with a nervous start, but it was only to find himself handing Mrs. Wetherill into the carriage. The Wetherills always went to church. They belong to the vast group of human automata who go through life without neglecting to perform a single one of the gestures executed by the surrounding puppets. It is true that the Bellomont puppets did not go to church, but others equally important did, and Mr. and Mrs. Wetherill's circle was so large that God was included in their visiting list. They appeared, therefore, punctual and resigned, with the air of people bound for a dull tea home, and after them Hilda and Muriel straggled, yawning and pinning each other's veils and ribbons as they came. They had promised Lily to go to church with her, they declared, and Lily was such a dear old duck that they didn't mind doing it to please her, though they couldn't fancy what had put the idea in her head, and though for their own part they would much rather have played lawn tennis with Jack and Gwen, if S.E. hadn't told them she was coming. The Mrs. Treanor were followed by Lady Cressida Wraith, a weather-beaten person in Liberty silk and ethnological trinkets, who, on seeing the omnibus, expressed her surprise that they were not to walk across the park, But at Mrs. Wetherell's horrified protest that the church was a mile away, her ladyship, after a glance at the height of the other's heels, acquiesced in the necessity of driving, and poor Mr. Grice found himself rolling off between four ladies for whose spiritual welfare he felt not the least concern. It might have afforded him some consolation could he have known that Miss Bardett really meant to go to church. As he had even risen earlier than usual in the execution of her purpose. As he had an idea that the sight of her in a gray gown of devotional cut, with her famous lashes drooped above a prayer book, would put the finishing touch to Mr. Grice's subjugation, and render inevitable a certain incident which, as he had resolved, should form a part of the walk they were to take together after luncheon. Her intentions, in short, had never been more definite. But poor Lily, for all the hard glaze of her exterior, was inwardly as malleable as wax. Her faculty for adapting herself, for entering into other people's feelings, if it served her now, and then in small contingencies, hampered her in the decisive moments of life. She was like a water plant in the flux of the tides, and today the whole current of her mood was carrying her toward Lawrence Selden. Why had he come? Was it to see herself or Bertha Dorset? It was the last question which, at that moment, should have engaged her. She might better have contented herself with thinking that he had simply responded to the despairing summons of his hostess, anxious to interpose him between herself and the ill humor of Mrs. Dorset. But Lily had not rested till she learned from Mrs. Treanor that Selden had come of his own accord. He didn't even wire me, he just happened to find the trap at the station. Perhaps it's not over with Bertha after all, Mrs. Treanor musingly concluded, and went away to arrange her dinner cards accordingly. Perhaps it was not, Lily reflected, but it should be soon, unless as he had lost her cunning. If Selden had come at Mrs. Dorset's call, it was at her own that he would stay. So much the previous evening had told her. Mrs. Treanor, true to her simple principle of making her married friends happy, had placed Selden and Mrs. Dorset next to each other at dinner, but, in obedience to the time-honored traditions of the matchmaker, as he had separated Lily and Mr. Grice, sending in the former with George Dorset, while Mr. Grice was coupled with Gwen Van Osburgh. George Dorset's talk did not interfere with the range of his neighbor's thoughts. He was a mournful dyspeptic, intent on finding out the deleterious ingredients of every dish, and diverted from this care only by the sound of his wife's voice. On this occasion, however, Mrs. Dorset took no part in the general conversation. She sat talking in low murmurs with Selden, and turning a contemptuous and denuded shoulder toward her host, who, far from resenting his exclusion, plunged into the excesses of the menu with the joyous irresponsibility of a free man. To Mr. Dorset, however, his wife's attitude was a subject of such evident concern that, when he was not scraping the sauce from his fish, or scooping the moist bread crumbs from the interior of his roll, he sat straining his thin neck for a glimpse of her between the lights. Mrs. Treanor, as it chanced, had placed the husband and wife on opposite sides of the table, and Lily was therefore able to observe Mrs. Dorset also, and by carrying her glance a few feet farther, to set up a rapid comparison between Lawrence Selden and Mr. Grice. It was that comparison which was her undoing. Why else had she suddenly grown interested in Selden? As he had known him for 8 years or more. Ever since her return to America, he had formed a part of her background. As he had always been glad to sit next to him at dinner, had found him more agreeable than most men, and had vaguely wished that he possessed the other qualities needful to fix her attention. But till now, as he had been too busy with her own affairs to regard him as more than one of the pleasant accessories of life. Miss Bart was a keen reader of her own heart, and she saw that her sudden preoccupation with Selden was due to the fact that his presence shed a new light on her surroundings. Not that he was notably brilliant or exceptional. In his own profession he was surpassed by more than one man who had bored Lily through many a weary dinner. it was rather that he had preserved a certain social detachment, a happy air of viewing the show objectively, of having points of contact outside the great gilt cage in which they were all huddled for the mob to gape at. How alluring the world outside the cage appeared to Lily, as she heard its door clang on her. In reality, as she knew, the door never clanged. It stood always open. But most of the captives were like flies in a bottle, and having once flown in, could never regain their freedom. It was Selden's distinction that he had never forgotten the way out. That was the secret of his way of readjusting her vision. Lily, turning her eyes from him, found herself scanning her little world through his retina. It was as though the pink lamps had been shut off, and the moldy daylight let in. She looked down the long table, studying its occupants one by one, from Gus Treanor, with his heavy carnivorous head sunk between his shoulders, as he preyed on a jellied plover, to his wife, at the opposite end of the long bank of orchids, suggestive, with her glaring good looks, of a jeweler's window lit by electricity. And between the two, what a long stretch of vacuity! How dreary and trivial these people were! Lily reviewed them with a scornful impatience. Carrie Fisher, with her shoulders, her eyes, her divorces, her general air of embodying a Pisce paragraph. Young Silverton, who had meant to live on proofreading and write an epic, and who now lived on his friends and had become critical of truffles. Alice Wetherill, an animated visiting list, whose most fervid convictions turned on the wording of invitations and the engraving of dinner cards. Wetherill, with his perpetual nervous nod of acquiescence, his air of agreeing with people before he knew what they were saying. Jack Stepney, with his confident smile and anxious eyes, halfway between the sheriff and an heiress. Gwen Van Osburgh, with all the guileless confidence of a young girl who has always been told that there is no one richer than her father. Lily smiled at her classification of her friends. How different they had seemed to her a few hours ago. Then they had symbolized what she was gaining, now they stood for what she was giving up. That very afternoon they had seemed full of brilliant qualities. Now she saw that they were merely dull in a loud way. Under the glitter of their opportunities she saw the poverty of their achievement. It was not that she wanted them to be more disinterested, but she would have liked them to be more picturesque. And as he had a shamed recollection of the way in which, a few hours since, as he had felt the centripetal force of their standards. She closed her eyes an instant, and the vacuous routine of the life as he had chosen stretched before her like a long white road without dip or turning. It was true she was to roll over it in a carriage instead of trudging it on foot, but sometimes the pedestrian enjoys the diversion of a shortcut which is denied to those on wheels. She was roused by a chuckle which Mr. Dorset seemed to eject from the depths of his lean throat. "I say, do look at her," he exclaimed, turning to Miss Bart with lugubrious merriment, "beg your pardon, but do just look at my wife making a fool of that poor devil over there. One would really suppose she was gone on him, and it's all the other way round, I assure you." Thus adjured, Lily turned her eyes on the spectacle which was affording Mr. Dorset such legitimate mirth. It certainly appeared, as he said, that Mrs. Dorset was the more active participant in the scene. Her neighbor seemed to receive her advances with a temperate zest which did not distract him from his dinner. The sight restored Lily's good humor, and knowing the peculiar disguise which Mr. Dorset's marital fears assumed, she asked gaily, "Colin, aren't you horribly jealous of her?" Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.